This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
We're here today with Dr. Giovanna Tinetti from University College London. Thank you for joining us on the Jodcast.
Hello.
And you've been giving a talk today entitled Exploring Exosolar Worlds. So before we get into your research, could we start off with a little recap of what we know about planets around other stars, how many we have, how we find them, things like that?
Absolutely. So first of all, an exosolar planet is a planet that is orbiting a star different from our own sun. And today we're already counting more than 538 planets.
So we should say today is the end of March 2011, because that number goes up and down, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's mostly going up, actually. It's increasing quite exponentially. So, yes, at today, we can count more than 538, but the Kepler space mission has provided already 1,200 unconfirmed planetary candidates. And so in the next few months and years, presumably, this 500-plus number will actually increase very rapidly.
And so what are the methods that we use to find these planets? You mentioned Kepler. How does that find planets?
There are several methods that are being used, actually, by the community to find new planets. Radio velocity is one of them. Radio velocity and astronomy, they're both looking at the wobble of the star, because when we say a planet is orbiting a particular star, in truth, it is actually the system, the star and the planet are both orbiting their central mass. And so when the planet is relatively massive, will induce a little bit of wobbling in the star as well. And so that wobbling can be detected through radio velocity, so basically using some Doppler shift of the light when the star is a little bit approaching the observer, or is going a little bit far away from the observer. Or with astrometry, you can basically measure the different position in the plane that is perpendicular to the observer. And so these two methods are sort of complementary in measuring this wobbling of the star due to the presence of the planet. Then another method that is also very interesting is the microlensing, that is more relying on the fact that light is actually can bend because of the gravity. So if we have a star that is really far away from the observer, from us, and another star with some planets is passing in between, we will have a temporary magnification of the light of the star that is very far away. And when there is a planet, then the kind of information, the kind of amplification is slightly distorted, and through that distortion we can work out the parameters of the star and the planet together. Then we have direct detection. With direct detection, we're trying to basically null out the contribution of the star and focus on the planet alone. And this can be done through different type of techniques. And at the moment, is certainly a method that is getting more and more interesting results. And finally, the transit method, which is actually the one used by Kepler, is basically detecting a planet when a planet is passing in front of the star. And so through that passage, we can basically measure the relative size of the planet and the star, measure very precisely the decreasing of the stellar flux, again, when the planet is sort of creating a sort of shadow to the star.
So in the transit method, the light from the star dips when the planet goes in front of it. Do you also see anything when the planet goes behind the star?
Yes, very good question, actually. What I just described is what we call primary transit method. But if we wait for the planet to be hidden by the star, then we can get a complementary information to the primary transit. And in particular, if we measure the star and the planet together, and then we wait for the planet to go behind the star, we can subtract out the contribution of the star, and so the final result is basically the light coming from the planet itself.
So is that not the reflected light, but actually emitted light from the planet?
To be entirely precise, it depends on the wavelength you're looking at. So what in what interval of the spectrum you're looking at and you're doing your observation. If you do your measurement more in the visible part of the spectrum, which is basically the part of the spectrum, part of light to which our own eye is sensitive to, then you will look at light that is reflected by the planet. But if on the contrary, you're doing your observation in the infrared, so the type of light that is more measuring the thermal property of the planet, then we talk of emission spectrum.
And the transit method of detecting planets seems to have been very fruitful recently, and it's quite interesting that the types of telescopes that you need to do this don't seem to have to be, they don't seem to have very large mirrors. It's more about having a good camera on the back of it. Does that make it easier to use that method to detect planets?
Well, certainly one of the reasons why transit method has been so successful is that you don't require, as you're saying, a huge telescope or a very sophisticated type of equipment. Just to give you an idea, you can basically detect a transiting planet from, for instance, the observatory of London. We're talking about an amatorial type of telescope, so 50 centimeter type of telescope. I mean, clearly the London weather is not the best suited for this kind of observation. But since for detecting a planetary transit, you just need to detect 1% of the light of your star. That can really be done even with very, very small telescope and even with local type of telescope, so even from the UK, very easily.
So with the transit method, I guess you're not sensitive to planets like the Earth, because if you think about the Earth taking 365 days to go around the Sun, if someone was on another planet looking at us, the amount of time we spent in front of the Sun wouldn't be very long. So what kind of planets do you find with this method?
When I was talking about 1%, I should have been a bit more precise. 1% is roughly the number you would get for a planet that is more or less as big as Jupiter, and a star that is more or less as big as our own Sun. But, you know, not all stars have the same size. There are stars out there that are much smaller than our own Sun or much bigger. And so depending on that, you might be able actually to detect planets which are smaller than Jupiter, and so more type of terrestrial planet or Neptune type of planet. And you can do that relatively easily depending on what type of star you're selecting. As you pointed out, though, if a planet is very distant to the star, so it's very far away from the star, I don't want to say it's impossible to detect a transit, but it's impractical. Because if you have, for instance, to wait 1 year before you detect another transit, then it's clearly a bit impractical. But most of the planets actually detected with this method are located very close to the star. And so either they're very, very hot planets, or if the star is much colder than our own Sun, then although they are closer, they might maintain a temperature that is a bit milder. So not necessarily some extreme cases.
Seems like you're sort of playing a statistics game when you try and detect them, in that presumably most of the stars that you look at don't show signs of planet transiting across them, but you just reckon to look at enough stars to be lucky. What sort of fraction of stars that are monitored actually show a transiting planet?
Well, actually, the statistics that the Kepler mission is showing us, it's quite mind-blowing, because detecting 1,200 candidates in such a little time It means that they're giving us the information that exosol planets are very common. And this is a kind of statistic that is certainly confirmed by our technique, by radio velocity or microlensing. So although roughly we can say that among all the possible orbits, just 2% of the planet that are present around the star are really transiting. Still, if most of the stars have at least one planet, you can do your math, and it turns out that then it's not so difficult then to discover some of this transiting one. And again, I guess that in the next few years, surveys from the ground and Kepler will tell us even more about this kind of statistics.
So you've alluded slightly to your research. We were talking about how you could get information about the atmosphere from a planet by the secondary transit. So can we go into a bit more detail about that?
Yes, of course. Clearly, it's very, very interesting to know how many planets are out there and understand how these kind of statistics will be improved by this different technique in the future. But personally, I am more biased towards the understanding of the properties of the planet rather than finding new ones. So what I'm personally very interested in is trying to understand the chemical properties or the thermal properties of this planet, and so having a better idea of how they formed, how they really look like, how they will evolve. And so trying to put basically the planets in our own solar system in a broader context. So in order to do that, detecting the planet is not enough. You need to go a little bit more in detail. And transit method is actually very, very good in telling us more about these fiery worlds. And the idea here is you want to repeat the same type of observation at different wavelengths, so primary transit or secondary eclipse. And by repeating it at different wavelengths, you can basically measure really a spectrum of the planet. And a spectrum tell us a lot. In particular, we can infer the molecules that are absorbing in that particular atmosphere, because every molecule has its own spectral signature. And so by looking at a spectrum emitted or reflected or transmitted by an exosolar planet, we can really work out the chemical composition. We can basically infer also some of the thermal properties if we're looking at this planet in the infrared. And so all this information constrain some of our models and some of our understanding of these very strange type of objects.
So you spoke about spectroscopy and photometry during your talk, and the difference between them might be a little bit subtle. So could you tell us what the difference is and what you find out from the two different methods?
Of course. Well, it's photometry and spectroscopy, the only difference is that in a spectrum, it's like you're having a lot of photometric measurement, but with very narrow band. And so when you look at a particular planet in a spectral interval that is relatively broad, and so you collect all the light in that relatively broad interval, then you're having a photometric measurement.
So that's the intensity as a function of frequency, but with quite a, as you say, broad bins of frequency.
Yes, it's a very big bin, yeah. And most of the time you just have one bin, and that's it. But ideally, you want to have multiple bins, because ideally you want to have a differential measurement. And so if you're able to have multiple bins, and hopefully not very large type of bin, but more narrow, then you can have what we call a spectrum. So it's a repetition of photometric measurement. Hopefully the band is not really very large, but relatively narrow.
And then you're catching the particular wavelengths of light that come out in a very narrow band from specific molecules. And you can match that up, I suppose, to what we know in from lab measurements of what those molecules do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, clearly, depending on what kind of molecule you want to detect, the kind of what we call spectral resolution, so the kind of binning that you need will be different. For the main molecules, especially if this one have broad signal throughout the spectrum, like, for instance, water vapor or methane, you usually don't need a very high spectral resolution. You can get away with a few photometric bands, at least just to say it's there. Clearly, if you want to know a bit more, like what is the abundance, or try to find out weaker type of signature, so molecule that are not so abundant in the spectrum or for which the signature is weaker, then clearly you need to have a high resolution type of spectrum. So the higher is the spectral resolution, the more photons, the more lights you need to be able to collect, clearly. So the more difficult is your observation, and presumably the more sophisticated is the kind of answer that you can have.
So a lot of people, when you talk about hot Jupiter planets, for example, you kind of think they're all the same. But in your talk, you drew an analogy with how the Earth and Venus might be at similar distances from the Sun, might look similar, but actually have very different chemical compositions in their atmospheres. So do you see a range of molecules and elements in these atmospheres, or do you see the same, or are you only looking for specific molecules so you might not find the weird ones that you might not expect?
Well, I certainly expect a lot of variety, even in the class of what we call hot Jupiter, so this gastrian planet orbiting very close to the star. I expect that because, for instance, if you change the type of star, the spectrum from the star, so the light that is detected from the star at different wavelengths will change, and presumably because of that, the type of photochemistry that can be that can occur on the planet will definitely change with different stellar type. So a G type of star like our own Sun clearly will radiate a planet in a very different way from which, for instance, an M dwarf, so a star that is much smaller than our own Sun and colder, would presumably irradiate the planet. I mean, M dwarf I expect, for instance, to be quite active, especially in the X-ray. So clearly the type of radiation will be very different. So why I should think that the photochemistry is the same for planets that are actually orbiting different type of star? I certainly expect not. Then, even a slight difference in the distance might cause a slight difference in temperature. And also in that case, for the thermal structure or for the thermochemistry, that might clearly create a change in the overall atmospheric situation. Also, the process of formation of the planet, presumably, in the outer region of the planetary system, and then the migration possibly might be different depending on different planets or the evolution. If you're looking, for instance, at different stages of the history of this planet, unfortunately, most of the time we don't really know even the age of the star. But clearly, if we look at the early Earth, it would have been very different from the Earth that we see today. And so it's probably the same situation for exosolar planets. So all this put together tells me and also my colleague that, I mean, we're certainly expecting a huge variety out there. Now, clearly, with the type of observation we're doing today, we are not most of the time extremely sensitive to all these variations. So it's sure that with future observation and improving the accuracy, we might be able to perceive these differences. Today is still a little bit difficult, but we're already seeing a few of them. So,
what kind of atmospheres have you seen up to now, or have people found?
Well, clearly we're starting much more with these hot Jupiters because these are the most favorable planets to detect, but also to characterize. They're hot, they are very bright, they are very big, and so all the possible conditions for a good observation. But then the difficulty and the challenges, even if they're increasing with smaller planet and colder planet, still people address the case of the warm Neptunes. So planets as big as Neptune and with an atmosphere that is roughly 600 Kelvin. So again, something that is very is much colder than these hot Jupiters. And I would say at the moment there is this what we call super Earth, a large terrestrial planet with a mass that is roughly five Earth masses. It's called the GJ1214b. And this particular object that has a temperature that's roughly 400 Kelvin, so again, colder and smaller, has been indeed measured by several teams and telescopes. So we're already touching the area of a large terrestrial planet and not temperate condition, but still not so hot either.
So what molecules do you detect?
Well, for hot Jupiters, water vapor, methane, CO2 and CO are believed to be there because multiple planets, a team and instruments were recording similar situations.
So all sort of things that we find in the Earth's atmosphere.
Yes. Although the main difference is that the main molecular component of these hot Jupiters is hydrogen. So all these molecules are clearly present in a very different environment, and especially the temperature is at least 1,000 Kelvin, so it's much, much hotter. But you're right. I mean, these are the sort of ingredients that we can find in the Earth atmosphere as well. For the warm Neptune, we believe then presumably methane is the main component of the hydrogen. And for the super Earth, is still a bit unknown, I would say, because although a lot of observations were recorded, these are not conclusive yet. So it's hard to say today exactly what it's in, but I would say in one year or so we should be able to put more constraint in that type of environment.
We should probably say that Kelvin is a measure of temperature and that 0 degrees centigrade is 273 Kelvin.
And a little bit, yeah. So yes. Earth temperatures are roughly around 300 Kelvin or so.
Yeah.
So when we talk about cool being 600 Kelvin, that's quite hot compared to anything that occurs on the Earth. But with these hot Jupiters, you're talking about well in excess of oven kind of temperatures, aren't you, with 1,000?
Yeah, you're right. Clearly everything is relative, and what we say not so hot at the moment are still the temperature at least of Venus. So clearly not very habitable type of environment, but still, as you're pointing out, the thermometer has gone down from 1,000 Celsius more or less down to 500 or so, and so clearly we can see a shift towards the more temperate type of conditions.
Well, one thing that certainly captured my imagination in your talk, which I had really not thought about before, was the possibility of detecting moons around planets around other stars. Could you tell us how you might go about finding them?
Absolutely. Yes, this is a very exciting topic. And in particular, a person that really has devoted a lot of effort into that is my student, David Keeping. Right now, I shouldn't call it students anymore because he has a PhD and he's in Harvard. But he certainly put a lot of effort during the past 3 years in trying to work out a method to detect moons orbiting exosolar planets. And he worked out basically this method, having the numbers from the Kepler mission, which is clearly a very interesting mission, able to provide a very accurate type of result through transit measurements. And basically here the idea is if a planet has a moon, then the moon and the planet will orbit their own central mass, a little bit like radio velocity type of situation. And so the planet will wobble a little bit because of the presence of the moon. And this wobbling can be detected if the planet is transiting. Because if it's transiting, then you should be able to detect few changes in the duration of your transit or in the real timing of this transit. So although we're talking a very, very little number, Kepler should be able to do that. And so right now he and a lot of our people at this point are working with Kepler data to try to detect moons around exoplanets. So it's certainly quite mind-blowing.
So you don't get a transit of a transit or anything like that. It's that the wobble in the position means that if you see consecutive transits, they'll be slightly different if you put them on top of each other.
That's correct, because he worked out the transit of the transit, and that's too small.
Okay.
And also detecting the moon through radio velocity, also the numbers are really too small for nowadays telescopes. So the only really way to detect it today is to work out this wobbling and this variation in the transit timing of the main planet.
So have you actually found any yet?
Not that I know. But clearly it would be a huge discovery.
If there was actually a binary planet, is that something that could exist close enough to transit around? Is that something that could exist close enough to have observable transits, and could you then see a kind of double transit signature? Is that possible?
I would expect so, because, I mean, the fact that, for instance, in the Kuiper Belt, there are a lot of asteroids that are binary asteroids tells us that, you know, the two-body situation is probably relatively common. Mm. And so why not thinking of a binary planet? So nothing has been detected yet with that in that type of configuration, but I would expect that maybe there are some sort of situation out there. Why not? Sometimes all these exoplanets planets are telling us of realities that are far beyond our imagination.
So before we were talking about how the Earth's atmosphere has changed over the years, and maybe recently changes in the Earth's atmosphere would be due to life. So could you ever find yourself in a situation where you might think there's life on an extrasolar planet by looking at its atmosphere?
Well, why not? Although it's a very challenging situation, and I'm not entirely sure we are completely prepared to that, it's fair to say that if we compare the situation of the early Earth when life was not there, the type of ingredients in the Earth atmosphere were very different from the Earth today. And so, for instance, today we have 21% of our own atmosphere is occupied by oxygen, molecular oxygen. Now, 21% of molecular oxygen in atmosphere is completely out of chemical equilibrium, because oxygen is a very reactive type of molecule. And so without life, so without a constant source of this molecular oxygen, you would expect in a very brief time, then the oxygen is just reacting with other type of chemical compounds and just disappear from the form of molecular oxygen. So the fact you have a constant source, and the fact you can actually from remotely detect the presence of molecular oxygen in the Earth atmosphere makes us speculate, how about, I don't know, finding a similar situation on our planet? Could that situation tell us about the possible presence of life? I think that from a theoretical point of view, I don't see any fault. And this entire idea actually was proposed back in the 60s by Lovelock, this British biologist that proposed this idea that planet, if it's inhabited, will evolve in a different way from a completely abiotic type of planet. And so one side the type of environment is influencing the evolution of life, like Darwin told us. But the other, on the other end, the life on a planet is able to make some changes of the atmosphere and on the chemistry that possibly can be detected from with remote sensing, so from very far away. So why not pushing this theoretical idea to the exosolar planets and to the detection of life, in other words, is from a theoretical point of view quite flawless type of thinking. And I really like to speculate in that sort of idea, although today clearly we don't have yet example of such planets.
I'm sure if there was a detection like that, the SETI project would immediately start concentrating on it, looking for electromagnetic emission.
Yeah, although we should separate a bit the two things, because what SETI is trying to do is to communicate with our worlds, and so by doing that, it's implying that not only there is an inhabited planet, but the living forms on that planet are civilized enough to send us and to communicate, send messages and communicate with us. Honestly, the entirety of Lovelock and what we call today astrobiology is just to look at any form of life. Any form of life will presumably change quite noticeably the environment. And so you don't need to have an intelligent life for doing that. So we are less, how to say, selective with respect to SETI.
If you find different elements in different planet atmospheres, does that tell you anything about how those planets formed, or is it just more an idea of the light that's coming from the star and things like that, if that makes sense?
It does, it clearly does. I mean, trying to understand first of all what look the planet like today, then the next question is, okay, you're looking at this particular chemistry and, you know, for instance, that after certain amount of observation, you can work out how much water vapor you have, how much methane, carbon dioxide, etc., etc. But then the next question is how you got there, why this planet is exactly as you're observing today. And so is it due to the formation process? Is it due to the evolution? Is it due to our processes in between? And clearly these are the kind of questions that we want to address. And the only way to do so is to look at several examples of maybe similar type of planets in the same type of class. And by comparing differences and similarities, maybe work out a better big frame, a big picture of what is really going on.
So as a last thing, what are you hoping for in the way of future telescopes or missions to study extrasolar planets further?
Well, certainly the idea that we need to have a devoted mission to characterize these extrasolar planets, so to understand the chemistry, the composition, the thermal properties, formation processes, etc., etc., it's certainly not new. When it was just out of my PhD and I went to the United States, both in Europe and in the US, there was this very stimulating idea of building a very large telescope in space and use this very challenging technology to really work out all this question and characterize an exosolar planet. And back then we didn't know so many things as we know today. And so I guess most of the scientists started to think that for addressing such a big question, you needed to have a big and challenging mission. And that idea didn't work in the sense that presumably the technology that was proposed was way too expensive and way too challenging. But we have learned that we have our technique that we can work with, and the transit one is actually quite recent. And because of the combination of the use of the transit technique and this very recent observation done with Spitzer Space Telescope, or Hubble, or ground-based facility, we could work out our way to address the same question, just changing our method, and because of that, also change the kind of technology we need. It didn't change the idea to look at the characterization and the understanding of this exosolar planet. What it really changed, the way we get there. And so today in particular, we have a mission that is a mission concept that is entirely devoted to this type of characterization of exosolar worlds. And the mission concept is called ECHO, Exoplanet Characterization Observatory. And ECHO has just been selected by the European Space Agency for an assessment study, which means it's their way to have a closer look to what we propose and what we think is a sensible also from a technological point of view, mission. And I guess we have about one year time, more or less, to convince them that it's really worthy, the science is very worthy, and the technology is far from being difficult. And so we really want to convince them that that's the natural next step we want to address in a better way the question of characterization of exosolar planets.
So this is one of, I think, four missions that ESA selected.
Yes.
Only one of them will finally fly, is that right?
Well, my understanding is that out of the four, in 1 year time or so, they will probably go down to two. Then I guess let's see day by day how this will work out. I mean, what we need to do, I mean, from an ECHO point of view, is to really make sure that they have all the information and we really work out to tell them as best as we can how we want this mission and what is the science that we can do with this mission.
And when would it launch?
Well, if it is selected, then it will be between 2020 and 2022. So very, very soon from a space point of view. 10 years' time is really, very short time, actually.
And what would the instruments focus on?
Well, basically, ECHO would be, from a technological point of view, relatively simple. 1.2-meter telescope, which is about the size of Kepler, slightly bigger, but not that much. And while Kepler is just doing measurement in the visible part of the spectrum, because Kepler is interested just in detecting them, we want to repeat same type of measurement in spectroscopy, and so at different wavelengths, from the visible to the infrared. And because of this spectroscopic information, we can basically work out all the information of the chemistry and of the atmospheric properties.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting talk and interview.
Thanks so much for inviting me here.